Well, thank you so much for preferring me to President Obama and Mitt Romney. I hope that you'll still feel that it was preferable to come here tonight when the evening is over. This evening we're going to begin our investigation of world religions. What do we mean by a religion? A number of people have proposed a definition for what a religion is. When one examines the variety of definitions that are out there, it's surprising how similar most of them are. Most definitions of religion will agree that a religion is a group enterprise. You don't just have a religion by yourself. Most will agree that it involves faith or beliefs, things that cannot be known with scientific certitude. Most definitions of religion include a set of behaviors, a moral code, and rituals that are incorporated in the religion. Lastly, and most importantly, definitions of religion say that the object of religion is some higher power, something over and above our ordinary, everyday world of mundane experience. So you put all that together and you get a definition of religion like this. A religion is a group's system of beliefs and morals having to do with the supernatural. A group's system of beliefs and morals having to do with the supernatural. We're all familiar with a lot of religions. Let's just pick one. Islam. Is that a group activity? Sure. Does it involve a system of beliefs? A system of actions or practices. Not only a moral code, but also rituals. And lastly, is it directed toward that which is over and above the natural, the supernatural? Yeah, the definition fits. Christianity? Sure. Other religions we may not be quite so familiar with. Judaism? Oh, it's definitely aimed at the supernatural. It's a group activity, system of beliefs, system of practices, sure. We could go on with Hinduism, Buddhism, all sorts of other religions. And I think we would see that this definition works pretty well for what a religion is. In our series, beginning this evening, we're going to be discussing world religions. What makes a religion a world religion? Shinto, for example, is the original religion, as far back in history as we can go, of Japan. Is that a world religion? Would you class that on the same level as Islam, Christianity, etc.? I'd like to propose three criteria that make a religion a world religion. And if any one of these three criteria applies, then that religion will be considered a world religion. first criterion is number of adherents. If a world religion has as its number of adherents 1/6 of humanity, then clearly it's a world religion. It's a major, important global presence. The largest religion in the world is Christianity. Christianity has about 1.5 billion followers worldwide. Second largest religion in the world is Islam. It's got maybe 1.2 billion. Third largest religion in the world is Hinduism. Even though most Hindus are still on the Indian subcontinent, there are so many of them that clearly it should be included as a world religion. I'm reminded of an episode of The Simpsons, which I watch religiously, where Homer was standing with Apu beside him, and there was somebody in front that Homer was chatting with. I forget how they got on this topic, but Homer says, "Isn't everybody either a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim?" And Apu, standing beside him, mutters to himself, "There are 780 million of us." There's far too many Hindus in the world not to count them as a world religion. Fourth largest religion in the world is Buddhism. But there's quite a gap between Christianity, 1.6 or so billion, Islam, 1.2 billion, Hinduism, 3/4 of a billion, and Buddhism. Buddhism has about 300 million adherents. At any rate, that would be a first criterion of what makes a religion a world religion, is number of adherents. However, that's not the only criterion by means of which a religion can be considered a world religion. I would suggest, secondly, geographical universality. Christians are everywhere on the globe. So whether one uses the first criterion of a number of adherents or the second criterion of geographical spread, either way, Christianity would be a world religion. Islam is concentrated in North Africa, the Middle East, and Central Asia, as well as Southeast Asia. But nevertheless, that's a huge area of spread across the globe, in addition to which there's 11 million Muslims in France and so on. A third criterion that is used to discern which religions are world religions is historical importance. And it's here that we find a criterion by means of which we are able to include Judaism. There are approximately 18 million Jews in the world. 1.5 billion, 1.2 billion, 3/4 of a billion. All, now we're talking 18 million. It's very, very small by comparison. How many Jews were killed in World War II, 1939 to 1945? 6 or 7 million, they estimate. But we got 18 million now. That's 1 out of 4 Jews or so was killed in World War II. But Judaism is of such historical importance in giving us the set of world religions that we have nowadays that almost all academic courses on world religions include it, because from its stem, both Christianity and Islam. We divide world religions into two hemispheres. There are Western world religions and there are Eastern world religions. The Western world religions are usually said to include three religions, and that is in chronological order, which is the order in which we'll take them next spring, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. The Eastern world religions usually include four. And there we have, again, chronologically, Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, and Taoism. Because we're doing four lectures this fall on Eastern world religions, and we have to include introductory matter that we're talking about this evening, I have lumped the last two of those Eastern religions together and called them Chinese religions. So we're going to be covering Hinduism next week, Buddhism the week after, Chinese religions, meaning Confucianism and Taoism, the week after that. Who came up with these terms? If you were standing in Peking, China, and you looked to the west, what would you see as far as religions go? You would see Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, and Taoism. If you looked to the west across the Pacific, you'd see the United States, Canada, South America, Central America. You'd say that Western religions would be Judaism, Christianity, Islam. So who decided? Where would you stand on the planet in order to have Judaism, Christianity, Islam to the west and Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, and Taoism to the east? Well, Europe. It was the Europeans who began the systematic, scholarly investigation of religions. Comparative religions, this study is sometimes called. So we have inherited their terminology. What I'd like primarily to discuss this evening is the origins of religion. After all, religion, according to the modern scientific worldview, religion has not always existed. It could not have existed before the Big Bang, for example. Let's start there. We know there was no religion before the Big Bang. So when was the Big Bang? According to the evidence provided by the Hubble telescope the last couple of decades, we now know that the Big Bang comes on at 6:30 in the evening on Fox. No. The Big Bang was 13.7 billion years ago. That's when the universe as we know it exploded into existence. Originally, you just have a superheated, super concentrated plasma which inflates and continues to expand. As it expands, it cools. After a few thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, a star turns on here, a star turns on here, a star turns on here. Pretty soon you've got galaxies of stars throughout the universe. Still no religion. How about our solar system? When did the sun come into existence? When did the eight planets, right? No Pluto. Mm-hmm. When did that come into existence? Well, we know from dating of rocks, meteorites, asteroids, etc. Our solar system came into existence about 4.5 billion years ago. That's when the sun lit up, and that's when the matter orbiting it coalesced into planets. So we go from 13.7 billion down to 4.5 billion. We've already wiped out two-thirds of universal history just for the Earth to be here. When did life appear on the Earth? I would consider that the next major leap from coming into existence of our inorganic planet. That's estimated to be about 3.5 billion years ago. So it really did not take all that long, 1 billion years, for single-celled organisms, those without and those with a nucleus, to appear. And then, of course, you get the sequence of organisms that we're all familiar with from grammar school. The invertebrates, the vertebrates, all at this point still in the sea. Amphibians, reptiles, dominating with the dinosaurs. Dinosaurs started about 280 million years ago, so we're already down inside that last of the 13 billion. They started about 280 million years ago. They were wiped out about 66.7 million years ago. We're still not sure why. Probably in the asteroid that hit the Gulf of Mexico. But it could have been a disease, or it could have been volcanism erupting around the world. At any rate, when the dinosaurs died out, that gave our ancestors, those little mouse-like creatures that were scurrying around between the toes of Tyrannosaurus rex, that gave us an opportunity to take over the world. We had this huge, empty ecological niche. So we came into existence, developed over the years from the demise of the dinosaurs 66.7 million years ago. We have to go to 40 million to have the emergence of monkeys. We have to go to, excuse me, 65 million for monkeys, 40 million for the arising of the great apes, of which there are four. The gibbon, which appeared about 40 million years ago. The orangutan, which appeared about 17 million years ago. The chimpanzee, which appeared around 6 million years ago. And humans. Our ancestors, our first conceivably human ancestor, seems to have split with the chimpanzee around 5 million years ago, and it was called Australopithecus. Pithecus means ape, Australo means south. So called because it was found in the south of Africa. Australopithecus, you remember Lucy? You've all heard of her? If she were here beside me today, she'd be about 4 feet tall. She'd have a very chimpanzee-looking face with prognathism. The muzzle would be forward, brow ridge, etc. Her arms would hang well below her knees, whereas we humans have ours higher. Her upper body would be two-thirds of her height, and her legs would be relatively short by comparison. Our ribs are higher at the top, broader at the top, and narrower at the base. Hers were narrower at the top and broadened as you approach the waist. There's all these differences. Her cranial capacity was far less than ours. Her cranial capacity was about 550 cubic centimeters. Ours is about 1,050 cubic centimeters. Australopithecus probably had no technology at all except very primitive stone tools. If an Australopithecine were fortunate enough to come across the carcass of an antelope, in order to slice open the skin, they would crack a rock in order to get a nice sharp edge. And we've recovered a number of these cobbles, broken cobbles that were used as primitive tools and so on. Now I ask you, is there any evidence of religion among our most distant but conceivably human ancestor, the Australopithecines? No. In fact, they probably did not have language. No language, no clothing. They're basically living the life of wild dogs or wild monkeys still. There's no evidence. They're the first genus within, they're the first species within the genus Homo, which means same. We include them because there's similarities to us. But there's no evidence of religion among them. Eventually, Australopithecines gave way to another species within the genus Homo, and that's Homo erectus, so called it because it was discovered prior to Australopithecus. It was recognized to be an upright walker, and they thought, well, that must be the first one. They called it Homo erectus. We now know Australopithecines also walked upright. Homo erectus appears about 1.5 million years ago. We're getting awfully darn close here, aren't we? Out of that 13.7 billion? 1.5 million years ago, we know they lived in caves. We know that they mastered fire because we've uncovered down at the level of about 1.5 million years ago, we've discovered the earliest remains of campfires. That was in a site in China, not too far outside Beijing. Perhaps they wore skins as clothing. We don't really know because skins don't fossilize. Did they have religion? No evidence. We have no evidence of their having religion. For one thing, beliefs and practices don't fossilize. So even if they did have certain beliefs and practices, we have no evidence of it. We come now to the form of humanity that appeared just before us, and that was Neanderthals. You've all heard of Neanderthals? N-E-A-N-D-E-R-T-H-A-L. So most people say Neanderthal, but actually they were named after a fossil that was found by the Neander River in Germany. And in Germany, T-H is pronounced T, so Neanderthal is technically correct. This fossil was found in 1857, shortly after a war between Germany and France. So the fellows who uncovered this skeleton thought it was some French soldier who had a bad case of arthritis or something, because he was all deformed compared to the present. Neanderthals, if I had one standing here beside me, he'd be about 5.5 feet. fall, he'd be far more physically strong than I am, and not just because I'm a 95-pound weakling, because Neanderthals evolved to live in an ice age. The ice age lasted until about 10,000 BC. And so they are very sturdy and very muscular. We know, for example, that their pectoral bones, which for us connect right here to the collarbone, for them, they went up over the collarbone and connected in back on those scapulas, those triangle bones back there, which would have given them increased. People who study these matters estimate that a typical Neanderthal could have bench pressed 2,000 pounds. Without steroids. But the Neanderthal would still have had a ape-looking face. He still would have had the bony brow ridge as a single ridge going up across above his eyes. The lower half of the face, there'd still be some prognathism. It would still tend to jet forward a bit. Neanderthals showed up about 200,000 years ago. Not very far in the past. Any evidence of religion? Yes! We have now come to, this evening, the first evidence of religion in the world. Now, we don't have any writings from the Neanderthals. Writing wasn't invented until 3500 BC. We're talking 200,000 BC. So what evidence do we have? The Neanderthals buried their dead. They're the first species among genus Homo, to bury their dead. Now think about burial, just in and of itself. Why would you dig a hole and lower Uncle Fred into the hole and cover it up? Especially in the Ice Age. You know how hard it is to get that permafrost out? Is there any utilitarian purpose served by burying Uncle Fred? But why do that? Exactly. Exactly. As far as we know, Australopithecines, when their Uncle Fred fell over, they looked and went on about their business. As far as we know, when Homo erectus had their Uncle Charlie die around the campfire, somebody would drag him 100 yards away and let the jackals at him. It's only with Neanderthals that we finally have burial. And we don't just have burial, which in and of itself suggests religious inklings, but how they buried their dead also shows us that they were religious. I'd like to mention four characteristics of Neanderthal burials which seem to me to suggest that the Neanderthals had developed religion. These are in addition to the fact of burial itself. First is grave goods. They did not just hack a pit, lower Uncle Fred. After lowering Uncle Fred and before covering him, they would put in a spear alongside the body. or they would kill an animal and put it in alongside the body. We have approximately 250 skeletons of Neanderthals that have been discovered various places in the world. And some of them have shown up with remarkable grave goods. For example, sometimes you'll have in amongst the rib cage hundreds of little beads carved out of bone or antler, something like that. Do you know how long it takes to carve one little bead? And here's a couple hundred of them inside this female Neanderthal skeleton. Obviously, when the person was buried, he or she was clothed. These were decorative ornaments worn around the clothing, etc. Now, why? It's definitely inutile. It's definitely not useful for those who remain alive to be getting rid of spears and jewelry and animals that they could eat and so on. Why do they do this?
Believe in an afterlife.
Belief in an afterlife. Don't you think we can conclude definitely that they believed in an afterlife? I think that's a safe inference for us to make. We don't have any written records of their beliefs, but I think we can safely infer they believed that Uncle Fred would be alive somewhere where these goods might be of use to him. Oh, and that's another thing. What kind of an afterlife did they expect Uncle Fred to have? Probably a life rather similar to the life he led here. He's going to be in some realm where spears are going to be useful. He's going to be in some realm where it will be useful for him to show that he was a big chief and has all these jewelry and so on. So, kind of the concept of happy hunting grounds must have existed among the Neanderthals. Oh, another belief that I think we can safely infer the Neanderthals had. Now, the Neanderthals were not stupid. They knew that once you put Uncle Fred's body in the pit and covered it over, what's going to happen to that body? Crumble into dust. So they knew that the body was not going to wind up using the spear and using the animal and so on. What would?
Spirit.
Soul. They must have inferred the existence of the soul. So actually, burial and grave goods tell us a decent amount about Neanderthal beliefs. They tell us that they had some kind of respect for human dead. They tell us that they believed in an afterlife. They tell us that the afterlife was similar to this life. They tell us that there existed a component of a human being in addition to his or her material aspect. But I said there were four characteristics of burials. The first is grave goods. The second is use of red ochre, O-C-H-R-E. Now, red ochre is a mineral, sort of like rust. It's pinkish, reddish in color. One thing that we've discovered when we have exhumed Neanderthal burials is that after the body was lowered and before the soil was replaced, the Neanderthals would sprinkle powdered red ochre over the body. you now know as much about this as I do. But why would they use that? Ah, right. Instead of sprinkling black powder, or instead of sprinkling green powder or blue powder, they sprinkled a kind of a pinkish, reddish powder, which is the color of life, right? I remember when I was a kid, I was out with my dog, a car hit my dog, bounced it off into the ditch beside the road. I ran over to my dog, which was lying on its side with its lip had flipped up, and I saw the gum, the red gum, in about that length of time, 5 seconds, went from reddish to pale, almost white. Red is associated with life. And so, I don't know if they thought they were guaranteeing by this red ochre that the Uncle Fred would live in the next life, or exactly what it was for, but it again suggests the presence of religion among the Neanderthals. Thirdly, Neanderthal burials were close to Neanderthal campsites. Neanderthals lived in large caves, and when they buried their dead, they buried them right there in the cave with them. They didn't go off a couple of miles away or something, but put them right there so that every evening the ancestor would be present at the goings-on of the clan, the community. That suggests a kind of incipient ancestor worship. And that's underscored by the fact that ancestor worship is a part of a lot of present-day religions. Fourthly, I want to mention not a characteristic of all religions among the Neanderthals, but two specific instances of burial that are unusual. One of these was a Neanderthal that we discovered in a cave in northern Iraq, present-day Iraq, where the Kurds are nowadays. It's called Shanidar Cave. We discovered a Neanderthal burial in that cave floor. When we exhumed it, we discovered that before they lowered the body, they had gone out and picked a bunch of flowers and made a bed of flowers that they then lowered Uncle Fred onto. That certainly suggests the dignity that they recognized was due to one of their own. There's a caring here. The other unusual Neanderthal burial we found in eastern Spain in a big cave there. In the floor of the cave, we dug down, we found this skeleton. Guess what happened this time? They made the pit, they lowered Uncle Fred, and they sprinkled a bunch of dead butterflies over the body and then covered it up. Why butterflies? Why not snails? Because butterflies transform, right? They're caterpillars and they become these beautiful winged beasts that we see on Lunesta commercials. So what does that suggest? The soul, some kind of resurrection, or at least some kind of rebirth. Uncle Fred is going to take flight. He's going to be beautiful. Something like that. Well, that's all the evidence we have concerning Neanderthal burials. There is a second sort of evidence that we have for Neanderthal religion, in addition to burials and these four characteristics of grave goods, red ochre, keeping in the community, and unusual burials. The other evidence, in addition to burials, that we have for Neanderthal religion is what we call the cave bear cult. None of you has ever seen a cave bear because they went extinct about 8,000 BC. But cave bears were bigger than any bears that exist today. If I had a grizzly here beside me and he got angry, what would he be? Maybe 12 feet? You think 12? That seems reasonable. I'm 6. He wouldn't be more than twice me, would he? No. If so, I'm getting out of here. A cave bear was even bigger. And you can tell from their name, guess where they lived? They lived in these big caves that the Neanderthals desired as a great place to live. So we know that Neanderthals killed cave bears. That shows that they were organized, right? Because it would take a lot of Neanderthals as a group, like a pack of hyenas, to take down a cave bear. But the main thing that's religious about it is what they did afterward. More than once, we have found in the large caves that Neanderthals inhabited, about 4 feet off the floor, there will be a niche in the cave wall, either a naturally occurring one or one that has been hacked out into the stone. And in this niche, they put the head of the cave bear, which was quite large. Not only that, but they seem to have taken long bones from the cave bear's skeleton. Long bones means either the upper arm bone or the upper leg bone. And they stuck them into the eye orbits, orbital sockets of the eye, at a 45 degree angle. So it looks kind of like those poison signs. Now, we can't go further than that. We don't know what sorts of rituals they did in front of this cave bear skull, but it's suggestive. It's probably not as good evidence as the burials that they were religious, but they must have done something with this. Did they pray to the cave bear as a god? Did they pray to the cave bear not to come back as a new cave bear and kill them all? Were they propitiating it and asking it to forgive them for having killed it and taken over its home? We're not sure, but this is suggestive of religion also. So, from 13.7 billion years ago, we can go all the way down to about 200 BC. As the earliest evidence of religion existing in the universe. Excuse me? Yeah. Is that what I said?
200.
Oh, 200,000. Yes, excuse me. Thank you. Actually, there is some slight evidence, not for religion, but for a sense of the numinous. Numinous means spirits or when you come in contact with the numinous, you get goosebumps. That's what we mean by numinous. Numen was the Latin word for spirit or ghost. Actually, there is some evidence for a numinous feeling, but not for religion. We know what religion is, a group system of beliefs and practices concerning the supernatural. Among animals, there is some indication of that. For example, there have been a number of instances. This is still anecdotal evidence, but the evidence is accumulating, of dogs sensing when their masters have died. In one case, for example, a fellow in Scotland asked his sister to come stay at his apartment with his dog for the weekend, because the man was going up to visit the parents in northern Scotland. The man went up, visited the parents. The sister stayed in the apartment with the dog. On his way back Sunday evening, he was in a car accident and died. 8 o'clock at night. The sister reported that the dog became very agitated at that time. So, in the same way that dogs smell things that we don't, maybe dogs sense things across the line for us, but maybe not quite across the line for them. That would be interesting. I've heard it said that dogs, on average, smell 200 times better than humans do. Obviously, whoever said that never smelled my dog. Bloodhounds, who have the greatest noses in dogdom, smell 10,000 times better than humans do. That's why they're used for that. Anyway, another sense of the numinous among animals is seen in elephants. Elephants are herd animals. They form a troop, kind of like a human clan back in our early days. And when one of their members dies, a couple of the bull elephants in their prime, will put their tusks underneath the body, lift it, and carry it sometimes for several miles in order to place it in the elephant burial ground. Why do that? I don't think they have religion, but they have a sense of the numinous. Horses in Montana, wild Mustang herds, when one of their members dies, the rest will form a circle around it, all of them with their heads inward toward the fallen colleague. So, religion probably has its roots very deep in us, maybe in the cellular level, and it grows out of us into the flourishing set of religions that we're familiar with around the world today. Then comes us. We're now leaving the Neanderthals, coming to the last of the members of the genus Homo. Technically, I should be more correct. The genus Homo is us and Neanderthals. The grouping just above that, that includes us all the way back to Australopithecus, are called hominids. But again, you got the word Homo there for same. When did we appear on Earth? According to the fossil record, somewhere between 100,000 and 150,000 years ago. We're not quite sure, but somewhere in that area, humans started appearing on the earth. Right away, as far back as we can go, humans buried their dead. Humans lived in caves. Humans wore skins. Humans practiced decorative arts. So chances are, when we first emerged, being more intelligent than Neanderthals, we instantly took over their culture. The cultural traditions, primitive as they may have been, that the Neanderthals had developed. Including burial of the dead. So it appears that we humans have been religious from the beginning. With us, we can access a form of evidence of religiosity that is unavailable for any earlier creature. And that form of evidence is Paleolithic cave paintings. You've all seen those cave paintings, right? They would do a picture of a bison or whatever on the wall of a cave. We call this Paleolithic. Paleo means old, lithos means stone. So back in the old Stone Age, pre-10,000. In fact, our ancestors began painting on cave walls about 20,000 BC, about 22,000 years ago. And they continued painting cave walls until 10,000 BC. So for 10,000 years, our ancestors were painting in caves. These caves are mostly located in southern France and northern and eastern Spain. There are caves in those areas which you go in the mouth of the cave and there will be branchings like branches on a tree trunk that go off in a number of directions. Some of these caves go 2, even 2.5 miles down into the earth. If you look at all of the cave paintings that we have discovered, and we've searched for them, so it's unlikely there's any big ones we've missed. If you look at all of these hundreds of figures painted on cave walls, you discover that 95% of all of the depictions are of animals. The animals include bison, they include mammoths, which were still on the earth from 20,000 to 10,000. They include antelopes, like the ibex, had a beard. Horses, all kinds of animals. Why would you think that they would be so fixated on animals? They ate a lot of animals. Animals were crucial to them for their lives. We have actually exhumed Homo sapiens bodies, which were frozen in the ground from 10,000 years ago or whatever, and we have sliced open the stomach and examined the stomach contents. Estimates are that maybe 80% of the diet of our ancestors back then was meat, far larger than it is now. So animals were crucial as a food source. Chances are these ancestors who did the cave paintings lived in these caves during the summer when the reindeer and the mammoths and so on were in the north, and then they would move with those herds along behind them to winter grazing sites, which would be further south. Well, if 95% of the cave paintings are animals, that still leaves 5%. Another 3%, and these are rough estimates, but relatively accurate. Another 3% are, I guess you'd say, figures, abstract figures. For example, the spiral was very popular. They would carve into the stone a line that began on the outside, did a circular curvature, doing concentric rings down toward the center and finally to the center. Now we know from Celtic religion, which existed in historical times, that the Celts used that symbol of a spiral as a solar symbol. It represented the sun. And of course, sun worship was pretty logical among ancestral humans. After all, it requires the sun to give us light so we don't bang our shins all the time. It requires the sun to warm our bodies so we don't freeze to death. It requires the sun to cause crops to grow. Some inkling that something was ultimately responsible for our welfare was present and was associated with the sun. So you wind up with the god Ra, R-A, as the supreme god of ancient Egypt, and so on in other cultures. So spirals were popular among Paleolithic cave painters, 20,000 to 10,000. Triangles, upside-down triangles, were popular, with the apex of the triangle at the bottom and the flat base, so to speak, at the top. And often they would put a fairly short line from the apex into the interior of the triangle. Best guess is that this was an abstract representation of female genitalia. Female genitalia? Now, why would that be of interest to our earliest ancestors? Fertility. If the women are not fertile, if they do not provide children, we're gonna die out. And death was far easier back then than it is now. The average lifespan of a Neanderthal, based on those 250 skeletons that we found, was 25 years. If you made it to 25 among the Neanderthals, you're an old man. We found one Neanderthal skeleton that was all crippled up with arthritis at the time that it died, which means that the rest of the troop, the rest of the clan, had been helping him for years along their journeys. Another abstract figure, I guess you could say, more concrete than those two, the spiral and the upside down triangle, was the handprint. There are a number of instances in the Paleolithic caves where somebody would put his hand up against the cave wall, and then he would use a hollow stem from a plant that he had hacked off. He would fill his mouth with carbon, black carbon from the campfire after it had gone cold. And then with his hand on the wall, he would go and blow the carbon through the tube, and it would smatter around the handprint. He takes his hand off, and voila, you have a signature. I did this painting. Now that's speculative. We don't know if that's the purpose of the handprints, but could be. Ancient Michelangelos signed their names that way. So 95% of the cave paintings are animals, 3% are abstract geometrical type things. What's the last 2%? Humans. And of course, how our ancestors from 20,000 to 10,000 depicted other humans is the best place to look for evidence of religion among our Homo sapiens ancestors. Now, most of the human depictions, it's only 2% of all the paintings, but most of that 2% is stick figures. For example, there's a painting of a bison surrounded by stick figures, a circle for the head and four lines for the body. Some of these stick figures are holding arrows. Some of them are holding bows. Some of them are holding lances or spears. This is obviously a depiction of a hunt, don't you think? So not many of the depictions of humans tell us much. But there are two paintings among the Paleolithic cave paintings that tell us a lot about religion among our earliest ancestors. Oh, by the way, the Neanderthals, which began around 200,000 BC, went extinct about 30,000 BC. Is that because the Ice Age was ending and they were no longer adapted to their environment? Is it because we ate them all? Nobody knows what happened, but they're gone. Anyway, two pictures in particular give us evidence of religion among our ancestors. One of these we refer to as the beaked man. It's a picture of a bison with a lance coming from its top rear down and emerging from the stomach, halfway between the front and last legs. And there are two loops that indicate intestines hanging out. Lying on the ground in front of this bison is a stick figure. But this stick figure has two details lacking in ordinary stick figures. One is an erection. The other is he's got a beak. Not just a flat face like us, but the lower half of his face forms a cone. And it's split and the mouth is a little open. Right next to him, opposite the bison, on the other side of him, is a stick. It looks to be about two-thirds the height of the man. And on the top of the stick is a bird. So those three figures are in some kind of ensemble, apparently. What are we to make of this? Well, the earliest form of religion that we know of in the historical record, after the invention of writing in 3200 BC, only 5,000 years ago, is what we call shamanism. You've all heard of shamans. A shaman is the religious leader in a hunter-gatherer clan or tribe. Back before the invention of farming, humans were hunters and gatherers. Every day, the men, when they got up in the morning, would go off together into the landscape to hunt. The women would gather the babies and the children and go off into the forest or the jungle and scrounge for nuts, berries, tubers, whatever they could, grains, whatever they could find. They all got together in the evening and had supper. So the economic system that we humans lived in for 98% of our existence, and I'm talking here about modern humans, from say 100,000 up until the invention of farming, around 10,000, was this hunter-gatherer system. Psychologists have noticed that there's a difference between female and male brains when it comes to giving directions. If I'm in, let's say I'm over in Victoria, which I've never been to, and I want to find the St. Michael's Church, and I enter the city on the main street, I roll down my window, because there's a woman going by, and I say, how do I get to St. Michael's Church? And she says, well, you go on up here till you see the Kroger, and then you go right, you'll see the nail salon on the right. Take a left there, it's about 4 blocks. If instead I rolled into town, took down my window, there was a guy going by, and I said, how do I get to St. Mary's? He would say, go 4 blocks to Ross Street, take a right, you'll come to Sanford, take a left, 2 blocks. We men tend to think in terms of kind of a grid pattern over the whole landscape. Women think in terms of local landmarks. This has been well established in psychology. Why is this difference existing? Because for 98% of human existence, the guys went trekking long distances every day, and the women went to the local forest or whatever. So we were hunter-gatherers for most of our existence, and those who did the cave paintings were hunter-gatherers as well. Now back to the beaked man. A shaman is the religious specialist in a clan or tribe of hunter-gatherers. By the way, estimates are that it takes about, on average, takes about 20 square miles per person to live this hunter-gatherer lifestyle. Consequently, if you are a group of 12 people, well, let's make it 10 people, then you need 200 miles to support yourselves. Hunter-gatherer groups never got much bigger than 30 at the most. So fairly small. And because they were fairly small, they did not need complex human organizations. Basically, they needed a bunch of men who would be the braves to fight off that group over the hill. They needed somebody to make political secular decisions, so they would have a chief among those braves. And they also needed somebody to deal with the beyond, the powers that be. And that would be the religious specialist. So it was a rather simple social structure. You had the 30 or so people, men, women, and children. You had the chief, who was in charge of everything except religious decisions, and that was up to the shaman. A shaman was believed to go off in trances where his soul would leave his body. These trances were sometimes helped along by various techniques. One technique is rhythmical percussion. Boom, 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 boom. Can you imagine me doing this for the next 8 hours? Would you not be in a trance-like state? Rhythmical percussion was used. Dancing was a way of altering your state of consciousness. You ever heard of the Whirling Dervishes? I went to see them when they were here in town several years ago. And they whirl in a circle until they have a kind of a mystical experience. Hallucinogens were known and used by hunter-gatherer tribes in historical times, so we presume that was probably the case back then. Eat a certain mushroom, you'll have an out-of-body experience. And in this out-of-body experience, you come in contact with the unseen world that is all around us all the time, but we just don't see it when we're in our mundane, everyday world. Now, what has the beaked man to do with shamanism? Why do I bring that up? Because one of the characteristics of a shaman is to have an animal helper. An animal helper of a shaman is referred to as a familiar. So if you go into the interior of Australia and you talk to the shaman there, he will say, yes, this wolf is my shaman. They probably don't have wolves in Australia. This dingo is my shaman, or my familiar. We're most acquainted with this concept of familiars with witches in the Middle Ages. What was the familiar that witches had? Black cats, right? Some kind of animal assistant to help with them. So, could it be that the reason this fellow is having a beak and the reason there's a bird right next to him is some kind of communication going here? Perhaps they thought that this shaman had the bird as an ancestor. When you have an animal ancestor, that's called a totem. Plus, he's lying down. And his arms are flung out. He looks, it's a stick figure, but he looks to be in some kind of a trance. He's not dead. He has the erection. We know from historical records that's a symbol of power. Think about European kings, pictures of European kings in the Middle Ages and Renaissance. They would always have that relatively short stick here that we call a scepter. That was kind of a phallic symbol, saying, I'm powerful. So, put all this together, it appears that the beaked man was a shaman. Now, I said there were two cave paintings that give us some information about their religion. Rather than discuss the second painting, I'm going to bring it up next time. See, this is my way of making sure you come back. I'm going to bring it up next time because it shed some light on the origins of Hinduism. But we'll reserve that for next time. Now, I brought us down to 10,000 BC, 12,000 years ago. It was around 10,000 BC that the second economic system that we humans have lived under came into existence. We can divide the economic systems that humans have lived under into three. 98%, the first 98%, we were hunter-gatherers. The next 11 and a half centuries, we were farmers. Farming was invented around 10,000 BC. The last 250 years, we've been in the third and perhaps the last economic system, and that's industrialization. So around 10,000, you have the revolution in economy from hunter-gatherer to farming. That's called the Neolithic Revolution. The New Stone Age begins with farming. And about 250 years ago, when we went from farming to industrial, you have the Industrial Revolution. So my question is, what was the effect of the invention of farming on religion? I want to suggest two effects that it had. Once you got farming, you domesticate plants. Instead of the women go scrounging every day, you bring the plants back to your domus, your home, and raise them there, which means you got a much more stable, much larger set of plants to eat. You domesticate animals. Instead of chasing them out across the fields, you bring them home, pen them in, raise them there. So one of the effects of the Neolithic Revolution was a population explosion of humans and a new concentration of humans, because everybody wanted to live in the river valleys where the soil was most fertile and you got the best return on your effort. So cities begin. The Latin word for city is civis. We could say civilization. The appearance of cities, dense collections of humans in river valleys, is a result of the invention of farming. Now let's say that one of these early cities, the city of Ur, for example, in ancient Mesopotamia, present-day Iraq, where Abraham is from in the Bible, that probably, around the time of Abraham, 1850 BC or so, had 2,500 people. In a small area, that's a heck of a lot of people compared to those 30 that existed as the largest grouping for 98% of our existence. What happens? You gotta have specialization of labor. Instead of everybody hunting or scrounging, we have all of those people raise the crops and raise the animals, and this group here is going to work metal, and this group here is going to be jewelers, and this group here is going to make flints, arrowheads, spearheads. This group here is going to fish, and the rest of you are going to be the merchants who sell all this stuff, trading agricultural goods for manufactured goods. Trade begins. Specialization of labor begins. Hierarchical governmental structures begin. And so you wind up with the classic four classes of king and priests, nobles or warriors, merchants and tradesmen, and the majority, peons, peasants, those who work the land, the grains and the animals. Now, what is this to do with religion? Because of these changes that resulted from the Neolithic Revolution, specialization of labor and complexity of or stratification of society, this gets reflected up into how the other world was imagined. So instead of, we don't know how many gods and goddesses there were before writing 3200 BC, but let's say instead of a dozen gods and goddesses that might have existed during the time of the Paleolithic cave painting, suddenly you've got lots and lots of gods and goddesses. think, for example, of Greek mythology. Zeus, Hera, Aphrodite, her husband Hephaestus, or Vulcan, who was the blacksmith of the gods. You get specialization of labor in the gods and hierarchical power relationships among the gods. So that's a major change in religion. Polytheism of a complex sort comes into existence. Sometimes as many as 400 major gods and goddesses in Yoruba religion, for example, West Africa. A second effect of the Neolithic Revolution was that goddesses became more important, and in rare cultures, sometimes took over the top spot among the gods. This happened in the Balkan Peninsula, Romania, Bulgaria, that area. Now, why would the invention of farming cause the status of female deities to rise? Because we noticed the relationship between women and the vegetative cycle. Every year, I plant the seed in the spring, it gets sun during the summer, I harvest it in the fall. Well, I plant seed in my wife, she develops for 9 months, and we harvest a child. There's the same powers that are in the earth, powers of fecundity, are also in my wife. So this elevated the status of female deities, if not of women. I don't know. But those were the two major effects of the Neolithic Revolution. All right, now the Neolithic Revolution was 10,000 BC. The Industrial Revolution was 250 years ago, 1750 BC. We've basically come down to the point where writing started, 3200 BC. And once writing starts, we can start talking about the development of the major world religions. Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, Taoism. So this evening we've covered primitive and prehistoric religions as a background for present-day world religions. Next week we start with the oldest, apparently, of the present world religions, and that's Hinduism. Thank you.